You had up to 50 people at some time or another working on
them? Yeah. I would guess perhaps even more than that. I just don't know. And so when we tried to inject it into a tumored animal, we found that there was an effect. It was toxic, so you had to keep the dose low, but nevertheless, at a dose which was tolerable, the tumors were disappearing. You take a mouse, you put a tumor into it, and you let it grow for a while, and you'll see some pictures downstairs of that too. Mm-hmm. And when it gets big enough, you inject the mouse with the drug, and the tumor disappears.
Mm-hmm. And it was a matter of finding the right dosage level at first?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Once we had that, we went to the Cancer Institute. I had a friend there, and they invited me down to give a talk on this. And they were rather reluctant to become interested, because the idea of putting a heavy metal into a person was an abomination. Mm-hmm. Heavy metals are poisons. Mm-hmm. And you're putting a poison into a person? No way. But I left samples with them, and they tested them, and they got the same results. Then they gave me a call asking me if I'd like to apply for a grant to continue the work. I accepted happily, and it began to expand. We published the results in Nature and other places.
And that's a British journal,
yeah,
isn't it?
It was the top biophysical place to publish something. Mm-hmm. And so word began to get around, and then I started to give lectures around, and other people became interested, especially a lot of chemists. Mm-hmm. look, chemists had no source of funds to do biological research. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of a whole field of chemistry now allowing us to get our foot into the field of cancer research, mm-hmm. You know, nobody else could do the chemistry research but the specialists in platinum chemistry. Mm-hmm. So they jumped on the wagon, mm-hmm. and very soon we had large numbers of people very much interested in this, and other people published, and it grew and grew, and eventually the Cancer Institute tried the in humans in 1972, and with success, and off we went. In 78, we got the patent on it, and at the same time, the FDA gave us the approval for injecting it in human beings. And out of the number of companies, there were about five companies that were interested in the license for it. Bristol Myers at the time, now Bristol Myers Squibb, got the license with the best offer, and they've been pursuing it ever since, mm-hmm. and with a fair degree of success.
Mm-hmm. Were there the political climate at the time in terms of research and the biomedical research that you're talking about? You indicated that it was a hard sell at first until obviously they saw the results. But could you talk a little bit about that? It was what, the late 60s, early 70s?
We're talking about when I went to the Cancer Institute, mm-hmm. it was in 1968.
Okay.
No. Yeah, it was 68 because okay. our first paper in Nature on the anti-tumor activity in an animal came out in 1968.
Okay.
And there's an interesting story about this. There was a gentleman, Sir Alexander Haddow, who was the head of the... now, here's one of the cases where I start to blank. Chester Beatty Institute in London, which was the major cancer research group in the world. And he was the head of it. He always had a feeling, right, that he took his MD degree in Edinburgh. Edinburgh is a hot spot for people working on homeopathy. Now, on homeopathy, you give a little bit of the poison that is causing the deleterious effects, and that cures it. That's the theory. That doesn't work. But he grew up in that. So when he also had the feeling then that if heavy metals are poisonous, maybe they ought to try them as anti-cancer drugs. And he did try them. And he even tried some platinum compounds. None of them worked. Then he came across my paper. He got on the phone, and I was in England 2 days later.
You were preaching to the choir.
I sure was.
Easy sell.
Right. And from that time on, we had a wonderful relationship with people going back and forth, and they're doing cooperative research with us, with the Chester Beatty Institute and the Cancer Institute and a bunch of other laboratories and major places. And so the success rate, particularly with testicular cancer, which was the greatest success rate they've ever had. I mean, at the time, the first time they tried it, I was at the Roswell Park Memorial Institute. They had, I think, I may not be absolutely certain of the numbers, but it was something like 25 individuals with advanced testicular cancer, of which about 21, the cancer disappeared. Now, they were not cured. The cancer came back. But they had never seen a response like this, a total disappearance of so many cancers in a deadly disease that killed 90% of the people. So they became very excited about it, and they too got into it, and testicular cancer became the primary one that they began to investigate. Then at the Roswell, in England and London, there's a hospital right next to the Chester Beatty Institute, Royal Marsden, at which a young woman doctor who was interested in ovarian cancer in women. And when she heard about this platinum, she called up the head of the British medical, something like the NIH here, and asked for permission to inject a few patients. And over the phone, he said, go ahead and do it. I mean, that's the beauty of not getting caught in a bureaucracy. It was this freedom. That England, they could do it. We couldn't do it here. So she then injected it, and she got beautiful results. And so ovarian cancer was added to the list. And then they started to do this into a number of other cancers. And so gradually it became a well-accepted therapeutic modality.
Were there difficulties in the sense that the people, or many of them terminal, the ones that they did the tests on initially?
All
were terminal.
Yeah.
And so that was the results were
The first test, the phase one test on a clinic for cancer, is always done on a terminal patient. Mm-hmm. Well, we couldn't cure cancer in those days, so they all were terminal, except for a few types of cancers, which were somewhat, some small amount of remissions would occur in them.
How did you come up with the name? Did you develop it yourself, or in terms of what's the story behind that?
I had a totally different name in mind.
What were some of those alternatives?
I was going to call it, platinamine.
Platinamine?
Yeah, because it had platinum and amine groups were important to it. So platinamine was the one I suggested. It was ignored by the Bristol company who had the license by this time, and they wanted to call it cisplatinum amine. Cisplatinum amine. And the licensing agent for trademarks refused to give it to them because of the name platinum in it. And so they had to change it. So they changed it to cisplatinum.
Cisplatin.
Right. They fooled the government because in Germany and in France, the name for platinum is either platan or platine. And which is just platin. So in essence, they got the name they wanted, but in a different language.
That's interesting. How was this discovery? How were you treated here at the university?
The cooperation was wonderful. About 5 or 6 faculty members joined in the research and did research projects in the laboratories. We've published with some of them. They were very, very happy with the whole thing.
What other departments were there? Was there any connection at this time with the new medical schools, or did that come later?
No, there was no connection with the medical schools at all. These were just individual science departments. Pathology, physiology, chemistry, biochemistry, a whole group of them. So this was part of the university was now growing, becoming more scientifically oriented, and being able to raise more money and funds from the NIH and other governmental agencies. And so you could see this is a growing process, and cisplatin was one of the most successful of the things that came out of this time frame in the university's growth. And of course it helped the university develop its reputation, raise funds and things of this sort.
In the medical profession, how did they greet this discovery at the time?
As I said, the initial reaction of a medical doctor would be, hell, that's a damn poison, I'm not touching it. And the side effects were pretty severe. And they almost dropped it until finally someone found out that if you hydrate the patient, that's not as toxic. This was discovered in Columbia University.
So you still had the positive effects of anti-cancer drug.
But it diminished the negative effects to the point of where it was acceptable. It's still a nasty drug, no question about it. But we found a better drug since that time.
What's that one?
This is carboplatin.
Carboplatin.
This is, we've tested thousands of drugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole panoply of inorganic chemistry was now open to us. And all laboratories that did any inorganic chemistry were playing around with different ones. They'd send it to us or send it to other places or do it themselves. But in any case, one of my students, one of my postdocs, went back to England and pushed something which he had done in my laboratory to a point of where it was accepted as a an interesting drug to experiment with. And he convinced other people to do so, and working with us. And out of this emerged a second drug, carboplatin.
Carboplatin.
Yeah. This was as good or almost as good as cisplatin, but the side effects were far less.
Has, although you started out or with in the initial test stages with testicular cancer research and then, or applications, and then ovarian cancer, are there any others that it has been applied to with success?
Oh, yes. Yeah. What's the name of the woman who's the head of the chemistry department right now?
I don't know.
Oh, I'm blocking on her name. I don't know why. Anyway, she was sitting here just a few months ago, mm-hmm. and she said she was very much impressed with the cisplatin story, mm-hmm. because she looked it up and she found that 40% of cancer patients receive cisplatin.
Oh, really?
Now, the number of different cancer types mm-hmm. is now about a dozen where it's the first drug of choice, including mm-hmm. lung cancer. Mm-hmm. I mean, it keeps coming up with additional things. People are working, well, let me just put it, there are well over 30,000 publications mm-hmm. having to do with the platinum drugs. Mm-hmm. Just an indication of the size of the groups. Mm-hmm. And they were trying it on all different kinds of cancers and finding a great degree of success in them. Mm-hmm. Not as good as testicular. Uh-huh. That remains the unique
the drug
one.
Of choice.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. 95% cures. Mm-hmm. Whereas it was a 10% cure mm-hmm. before that. Mm-hmm. That's a nice jump.
Yeah, sure. but have you received any personal letters from cancer patients or anything?
Hell yes. Did they? God. Mm-hmm. And they've come to visit me. mm-hmm. And you've heard the story of Lance Armstrong?
Oh yes. Would you? And did you have?
I had nothing to do with it.
Oh.
No, but he was cured with mm-hmm. cisplatin. Mm-hmm.
The famous Tour de France winner.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. yeah. and was, it happens to be a second story of that type mm-hmm. to have occurred with cisplatin. Mm-hmm. The first one was a British jockey. Who was one of the greatest jockeys in England and won the Grand Prix. Both his horse and he came down with a disease at the same time. They were going to kill the horse, and they decided not to, and it recovered. He was going to die, and then they decided to use the cisplatin on him, and it cured him. Mm. The horse got cured. They ran in the next Grand National, and they won.
Sounds like a movie script.
It is, actually. A book was written about it, uh-huh. and a movie, and I have a copy of the movie here. John Hurt played the part of the jockey. Mm. But it's interesting, and then now suddenly we have a second case, a famous athlete mm-hmm. Being cured with cisplatin and going on to win honors in his field.
Mm-hmm. So so it wasn't the end of life. And
no, it was great.
The in the 1970s, after all this was going on and the development, mm-hmm. how would you describe your life and work here at Michigan State at the time? Did it change significantly?
Yes, tremendously.
How so?
Well, sales started in 1978.
Okay.
And money started to flow into the university. And according to the contracts that the faculty have with the university, the inventors get 15%, which in this case, there were three inventors, so I got 5%. Mm-hmm. And it started to add up to a significant amount of money. And I wanted to put into place the dream I had, that I spoke about earlier, having my own laboratory, an institute of my own. I put it to the university that I would donate all of the royalties that I got if they would match it from their much larger portion of the budget of the royalties. And we negotiated for quite a long time, and there was some significant interest, but one man killed it. Mm-hmm. I won't tell you his name.
Mm-hmm. He
antagonized me for the first time on campus. Mm-hmm. Up to that point, I think MSU did everything they could for me. Mm-hmm. He did the first thing that turned me off. So I decided to go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I now had sufficient funds to have a laboratory. Mm-hmm. And I tried a number of places. And it was a good possibility, except for one problem. Those places where I wanted to live would not allow me to put a laboratory up next to it. Mm-hmm. And those places where I could put a laboratory, I wouldn't want to live. And so it was very frustrating. Mm-hmm. And after a while, I came back here, and a friend of mine found this place. Mm-hmm. It was a farm. Mm-hmm. And this was a horse barn.
Uh-huh. Lovely remodel.
Yeah, and that was just a flat farm there. Mm-hmm.
Close to the university. So.
Yeah, and so we could continue my cooperation with the university. We have joint contracts for doing research. And yet I'm here myself, my own boss. Mm-hmm. Nobody tells me what to do.
So you were involved in teaching directly after, at what point did you either retire what was that?
Our teaching loads were very low. Uh-huh. That was a decision we all made. Mm-hmm. 1/4 a year, because we wanted to emphasize research. Mm-hmm. And the students would take courses in other departments. There was very little biophysics that you could teach other than maybe a term or two. Mm-hmm. So in any case, at that time, I felt that my role at the university was at an end. And I chose to retire from the university.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
Actually, I didn't. I took a leave of absence.
Leave? Mm-hmm.
And that was in 1982. A leave of absence. And then we continued to work together with joint support of the research, but under my control. And that continued until 96, 97, at which time I then officially retired from the university. Mm-hmm. On my 70th birthday. Mm. But still maintaining the relationship we had.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved with any international programs or study abroad type things, or scholars? How you obviously attracted scholars from around the world.
Oh yeah, we had from all over the world. People came and worked with us. Mm-hmm. Or I would go there and lecture there and so forth. It was an international project. Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful example of cooperation between scientists. And there were no bastards in the group. Well, with one or two minor exceptions, I think everybody felt that this was too important to do nasty things. And there was full cooperation, open cooperation. We established a group of, not a group, an office to make copies of papers and send them to everybody on the list who wanted to become a member of the club. Mm-hmm. My wife ran it. Mm-hmm. She did a damn good job. Mm-hmm. There were some copies she would make of different things, and eventually, you know, she would send out papers or lists of recent publications, etc., and people would send us their publications or the even preprints, so that we can get it out as fast as possible. Wow. I mean, urgency was evident in all of the work.
Mm-hmm. If you think back your own development as a scientist, you mentioned John Hanna and his encouragement of freedom to do things. How would you describe your own approach to, let's say, tackling a scientific problem like a cure for cancer? Do you see any evolution in that over time?
Well, I see changes over time. Mm-hmm. I'm a fairly inventive individual, creative. That's probably my one good point. So I've gotten a number of reasonably good ideas and published them, and it's been accepted by others in the fields. And among the biophysicists, of course, I was fairly well known. Not amongst others, though.
Mm-hmm. How about your the recent studies on aging? Well, would you say that there's any...
I'm sorry. I hate cancer research.
Oh, you do.
Okay, that's the point that has to be made. I wanted to get out of it as soon as possible. And at a particular point in 1982, I felt there were enough good people in the field. It was well established. It was accepted. I could pull myself out. I was no longer necessary as the organizer of everything. So I decided to pull out of the field of cancer research. And that's when I started the aging research with an associate of mine, Dr. David Juckett. And so in the laboratory here, when we established it, aging research was the dominant thing that we wanted to do. And I think I'm off the topic of what you asked.
No, I was just asking what you made the change to that, and you talked a little bit about your 40th birthday and that sort of thing, but what would you say are the maybe some of the active things that you have discovered as a result of that research?
We have a lovely theory of aging that we've published about 15 papers on. Mm-hmm. We discovered lots of things. I don't want to go into all of them. Mm-hmm. We have a theory of how the nose works, for example.
Oh, really?
Yes. How does that differentiate smell? We're actually building a machine that would emulate what the nose does using the same mechanism as the nose does. That would allow you to distinguish odors. So that was a piece of our work.
Anything on memory? No.
Mm-hmm. There is something on memory, but I cannot talk about it.
Okay, I understand. Have you continued any of the cancer research?
Well, that was what I was coming to.
Okay. You intended to get out of it.
I intended to get the hell out of the field. And for a number of years, I was out of it. But then I was doing a study of how a population dies off with age as a function of time, of their age. And I got a very particular curve. It was a very interesting curve mathematically. And all of the diseases that we studied had the same shape of curve, but with different time constants. So some people would, given the disease, would die earlier and some later and so forth.
Well, in looking at your at some of your activities, were you involved in at the university itself? Were you involved in any academic governance or anything like that within the university?
In the beginning, I was one of two professors that were here, Leroy and myself. And there are various different jobs that a professor has to do, members of committees and things of this sort. And since Leroy was the chairman, by choice of all of us, I used to take those jobs, and I got tired of them.
Committee work, huh?
Yeah. So others picked it up afterwards, and I just dropped out. So I